Chapter 31, New Orleans, May 1870. Gallatin Street by night looked like the main road through hell, Abner Marsh thought as he hurried along it. It was lined with dance halls, saloons and whorehouses, all of them crowded, filthy and raucous, and the sidewalks seethed with drunks and whores and cut-purses. The whores called after him as he walked, mocking invitations that turned to jeers when he ignored them. Rough, cold-eyed men with knives and brass knuckles appraised him with open contempt, and made Marsh wish he didn't look quite so prosperous and quite so goddamned old. He crossed the street to avoid one throng of men standing in front of a dance hall and hefting live oak cudgels, and found himself in front of the Green Tree. It was a dance hall like all the others, a hell hole surrounded by other hell holes. Marsh pushed his way inside. The interior was crowded, smoky and dim. Couples moved through the bluish haze, shuffling vaguely in time to the loud, cheap music. One of the men, a thickly built, unshaven lout in a red flannel shirt, staggered around the dance floor with a partner who looked to be unconscious. The man was squeezing her breast through her thin calico dress as he supported her and dragged her about. The other dancers all ignored them. The women were all typical dance hall girls in faded calico shifts and tattered slippers. As Marsh looked on, the man in the red shirt stumbled and dropped his partner and collapsed on top of her, and a hoot of laughter went up. He cussed and got unsteadily to his feet while the woman lay sprawled out. Then, as the laughing subsided, he leaned over her and grabbed her by the front of her dress and pulled. The cloth ripped, and he yanked the garment off and tossed it aside, grinning. She had nothing on underneath except for a red garter around one white, meaty thigh with a little dagger stuck through it. The pommel was pink and heart-shaped. The man in the red shirt had started unbuttoning his pants when two bouncers moved in on either side of him. They were massive red-faced men with brass knuckles and thick wooden clubs.
"Take her upstairs," one of them growled.
The man in the red shirt started cussing a streak, but finally he lifted the woman onto a shoulder and staggered off through the smoke, accompanied by more laughter.
"Want to dance, mister?"
a slurred female voice whispered in Marsh's ear. He turned and scowled. The woman must have weighed as much as he did. She was pasty white and naked as the day she was born, except for a little leather belt with two knives hanging from it. She smiled and stroked Marsh's cheek before he turned away from her abruptly and pushed through the crowd. He made a circuit of the room, trying to find Joshua. In one particularly noisy corner, a dozen men were crowded around a wooden box, belching and swearing as they watched a rat fight. Around the bar, men stood too deep, near every one of them armed and glowering. Marsh muttered apologies and pushed past a weedy-looking fellow with a garrote looped through his belt, who was talking intently to a short man wearing a brace of pistols. The man with the garrote stopped and eyed Marsh unpleasantly, until the other shouted something at him and drew him back into conversation.
"Whiskey," Marsh demanded, leaning against the bar.
"This whiskey will rot a hole in your stomach, Abner," the barkeeper said softly, his quiet voice penetrating right through the din. Abner Marsh let his mouth fall open. The man behind the bar smiling at him wore rough woven baggy trousers held up by a cord belt, a white shirt so dirty it was almost grey, and a black vest. But the face was the same as it had been 13 years before, pale and unlined, framed by that straight white hair, a bit messy now. Joshua York's grey eyes seemed to shine with their own light in the dimness of the dance hall. He extended his hand across the bar and clasped Marsh on the arm. "Come upstairs," he said urgently, "where we can talk." As he came around the bar, the other barkeep stared at him, and a wiry, weasel-faced man in the dark suit charged up to him and said,
"Where the hell are you going? Get back there and pour them whiskies."
"I quit," Joshua told him.
"Quit? I'll have your damn throat slit."
"Will you?" said Joshua.
He waited, looking around the suddenly hushed room and challenging them all with his eyes. No one moved.
"I'll be upstairs with my friend if any of you care to try," he said to the half-dozen bouncers who lined the bar. Then he took Marsh by the elbow and led him through the dancers to a narrow back stair. Upstairs was a short hall lit by a single flickering gas jet and a half-dozen rooms. Noises were coming from behind one closed door, grunting and moaning. Another door was open, and a man was sprawled in front of it face down, half in and half out of the room. As he stepped over him, Marsh saw that it was the red-shirted man from downstairs.
"What the hell happened to him?"
Marsh said loudly.
Joshua York shrugged.
Bridget probably woke up, clubbed him, and took his money. She is a real darling. I believe she's killed at least 4 men with that little knife of hers. She carves notches on that heart. He grimaced. When it comes to bloodshed, Abner, my people have very little to teach your own. Joshua opened the door to an empty room. In here, if you will. He shut it behind them after turning on one of the lamps. Marsh sat heavily on the bed.
God damn, he said. This is a hell of a place you got me to, Joshua. This is as bad as Natchez under the hill was 20-30 years ago. Damned if I ever expected to find you in a place like this.
Joshua York smiled and sat down in a frayed old armchair. Neither will Julian nor Sow Billy. That is the point. They are searching for me, I know. But even if they think to search Gallatin Street, it will be difficult. Julian would be attacked for his obvious wealth, and Sour Billy is known here by sight. He has taken off 2 many women who have never returned. Tonight there were at least 2 men in the Green Tree who would have killed him on sight. The streets outside belong to the Live Oak boys, who might beat Billy to death just for the fun of it, unless they decided to help him. He shrugged. Even the police won't come to Gallatin Street. I am as safe here as I would be anywhere, and on this street my nocturnal habits draw no notice. They are commonplace.
Never mind about that, Marsh said impatiently. You sent me a letter, said you'd made your choice. You know why I come, but I ain't sure why you sent for me. Maybe you better tell me.
I scarcely know where to begin. It has been a long time, Abner.
For both of us, Marsh said gruffly.
Then his tone softened.
I looked for you, Joshua. For more goddamn years than I care to think about, I tried to find you and that steamboat of mine. But there was just too goddamn much river and not enough time nor money.
Abner, said York, you might have had all the time and money in the world, and you would never have found us on the river. For the past 13 years, the fever dream has been on dry land. She is hidden near the old indigo vats on the plantation that Julian owns, some 500 yards from the bayou, but quite thoroughly concealed. Marsh said,
How the hell?
It was my doing. Let me start from the beginning and tell you all of it. He sighed. I must go back 13 years to the night I took my leave from you.
I remember.
I went upriver as quickly as I could, Joshua began, anxious to get back, worried that the thirst would come upon me. Travel was difficult, but I reached the fever dream on the second night after my departure. She had moved only slightly. She now stood well away from the shore, the dark water rushing around her on both sides. It was a cold, foggy night when I approached her, and she was absolutely dead and dark. No smoke, no steam, not a flame showing anywhere, so silent that I almost missed her for the fog. I did not want to return, but I knew I must. I swam out to her. He hesitated briefly. Abner, you know the sort of life I have led. I have seen and done many terrible things, but nothing prepared me for that steamer the way I found her. Nothing. Marsh's face grew hard.
Go on.
I told you once that I thought Damon Julian was mad.
I recollect it.
Mad and heedless and dreaming of death, Joshua said. And he had proven it. Oh, yes, he had proven it. When I pulled myself up onto deck, the steamer was deathly quiet. No sound, no movement, just the river rushing past. I wandered through the boat unmolested. His eyes were fixed on Abner Marsh, but they had a far-off glazed look, as if they were seeing something else, something they would always see. York stopped.
Tell me, Joshua, Marsh said.
York's mouth grew tight. It was a slaughterhouse, Abner. He let that simple statement hang in the air for a moment before he went on. Bodies were everywhere, everywhere, and not intact either. I walked through the main deck and found corpses among the freight and back with the engines. There were arms, legs, other body parts, ripped loose, torn off. The slaves the stokers Billy had bought, most of them were still in the manacles, dead, their throats torn out. The engineer had been hung upside down above the cylinder and cut so. He must have bled down onto, as if blood could take the place of oil. Joshua gave a small, grim shake of his head. The number of dead, Abner. You can't imagine. And the way they were torn, the grotesque mutilations. The fog had seeped onto the boat so I could not see the whole at once. I walked, I wandered, and these things would suddenly appear before me where an instant before there had been nothing but vague shadows and a drifting veil of fog, and I would look at whatever new terror the mist had yielded up to me, and move away, and take only two or three steps before the vapours dissolved yet again to reveal something even more vile. Finally, sick at heart and filled with a wrath that burned in me like a fever, I went up the grand staircase to the boiler deck. The saloon. It was more of the same. Bodies and pieces of bodies. So much blood had been spilled that the carpet was still wet with it, even then. Everywhere I found signs of struggle. Dozens of mirrors were shattered. Three or four stateroom doors had been smashed in. Tables were overturned. On one table that still stood, there was a human head upon a silver platter. I have never known more horror than I did as I walked the length of that saloon, those terrible 300 feet. Nothing moved in the darkness, in the fog, nothing living. I moved back and forth listlessly, not knowing what to do. I stopped before the water cooler, that great silver ornamental water cooler you had placed at the forward end of the cabin. My throat was very dry. I picked up one of the silver cups and turned the handle. The water. The water came slowly, Abner. Very slowly. Even in the darkness of that saloon I could see that it was black and viscous, half clotted. I stood with the cup in hand, looking about blindly, my nose filled with the smell. The smell! I have hardly mentioned that. The smell was terrible. You can imagine, I'm sure. I stood in the midst of it all, watching that agonizing slow trickle from the water cooler. I felt as though I was choking. My horror, my outrage, I felt them rise within me. I tossed the cup across the cabin and I screamed. Then the noises began. Whispers, thumpings, begging sounds, weeping, threats. Voices, Abner, living human voices. I looked about me and grew even sicker, even more angry. At least a dozen stateroom doors had been nailed shut, their occupants imprisoned within them. Waiting, I knew, for tonight or the night after, Julian's living larder. I began to tremble. I moved to the nearest door and started to pull loose the boards that held it shut. They pulled out with a loud creaking sound, almost a cry of agony. I was still working on that door when he said, "Dear Joshua, you must stop that. Dear lost Joshua, come back to us." When I turned, they were there. Julian smiling at me, Sour Billy at his side, and the others, all the others, even my own people, Simon, Smith and Brown, all of them that were left, watching me. I screamed at them all, wild and incoherent. They were my people, and yet they had done this? Abner, I was filled with such loathing. Later, days later, I heard the whole story, learned the full depth of Julian's madness. Perhaps it was my fault, in a sense. In saving you and Toby and Mr. Fram, I brought on the death of more than 100 innocent passengers. Abner Marsh snorted. "Don't," he said. "Whatever happened, it was Julian that had done it, and him that has to answer for it. You weren't even there, so don't go blaming yourself, you hear?" Joshua's grey eyes were troubled. "So I have told myself many times," he said. "Let me finish the story. What had happened? Julian had woken that night to find us gone. He was furious, wild, more. Those words sound too feeble to convey what must have been his rage. Perhaps it was the red thirst in him that woke after all those centuries. Moreover, it must have looked to him as if destruction were near to hand. His pilots were all gone. The steamer could not move without a pilot, and he must have known that you intended to return, to attack by day and destroy him. He could not have guessed that I would come back instead to save them. No doubt my treachery and Valerie's desertion filled him with fear, with uncertainty about what would come next. He had lost control. He had been Bloodmaster, and yet we had acted against him. In all the history of the people of the night, it had never happened before. I think, during that terrible night, that Damon Julian thought he saw the death he both hungered for and feared. Sour Billy, I learned later, urged that they go ashore, split up, travel overland separately, and meet again in Natchez or New Orleans or somewhere. That would have been sensible, but Julian was past sense. He had just entered the main cabin, his madness seething in his eyes, when a passenger approached him and began to complain that the steamer was far behind schedule, that she had not moved all day. "Ah," Julian said. Then we must move it immediately. He had taken it a bit further out so no one could get to shore. When it was done, he returned to the main cabin, where the passengers were dining, and approached the man who had complained, and killed him, in full view of all. Then the slaughter began. Of course, people screamed, ran, hid, locked themselves in their staterooms, but there was no place to go. And Julian used his power, used his voice and his eyes, and sent his people forth to kill. I understand the Fever Dream had about 130 passengers aboard that night, against about 20 of my people, some driven by the thirst, some by Julian. But the thirst can be terrible at a time like that. Like a fever, it can leap from one to the next until all of them burn. And Sour Billy had the men he hired at Natchez under the hill assist in the fighting too. He told them it was all part of a plan to rob and kill the passengers and that they would share in the loot. By the time my people turned against their human helpers, it was far too late. It was happening even as you and I stood talking that last night, Abner. The screams, the carnage, Julian's wild death spasm. He did not have everything his own way. The passengers fought back. I am told that virtually all my people sustained injuries, though of course they healed. Vincent Thibault was shot through the eye and died. Catherine was seized by two firemen and thrust into one of the furnaces. They burned her to death before Kurt and Alain intervened. So two of my people met their ends. Two of us, and well over 100 of your kind. The survivors were penned within their own cabins. When it was over, Julian settled down to wait. The others were full of fear and wanted to flee, but Julian would not permit it. He wanted to be discovered, I believe. They say he spoke of you, Abner.
Me?
Marsh was thunderstruck. He said he had promised you that the river would never forget your fever dream. He laughed and said he made good on that promise. Abner Marsh's anger welled up in him and came out in a furious snort.
Damn him to hell,
he said in a strangely quiet tone. That, said Joshua York, was how it happened. But I knew none of that the night I returned to the fever dream. I only knew what I saw with my eyes, what I smelled, what I could guess and imagine. And I was wild, Abner, wild. I was tearing free those boards, as I said, and then Julian was there, and suddenly I was screaming at him, screaming incoherently. I wanted vengeance. I wanted to kill him as badly as I have ever wanted to kill anyone, wanted to rip open that pale throat of his and taste his damnable blood. My anger... Ah, the words are so useless. Julian waited until I had finished screaming, and then he said quietly, "There are two boards left, Joshua. Pull them off and let them out. You must be very thirsty." Sour Billy sniggered. I said nothing. "Go on, dear Joshua," Julian said. "Tonight you will truly join us, so you may never run again. Go on, dear Joshua, free him, kill him." And his eyes held mine. I felt their force pulling, pulling me inside him, trying to take hold of me and make me do his bidding. Once I had tasted blood again, I would be his, body and soul forever. He had beaten me a dozen times, forced me to kneel to him, compelled me to let him drink of my own blood. But he had never been able to make me kill. It was my last protection of what I was and what I believed in and what I tried to do. And now his eyes were tearing it down, and behind it was only death and blood and terror and the endless empty nights that soon would be my life. Joshua York stopped then and looked away. There had been something clouded and unreadable in his eyes. Abner Marsh saw to his astonishment that Joshua's hand was shaking.
"Joshua," he said, "whatever happened, it was 13 years ago. It's past. It's gone like all those folks you killed in England and such. And you didn't have no choice, no choice at all. It was you that told me you can't have good or evil without a choice. You ain't what Julian is, no matter if you did kill that man."
York looked at him straight on and gave a strange little smile. "Abner, I did not kill that man."
"No? Then what?"
"I fought back," said Joshua. "I was wild, Abner. I looked him in the eyes and I defied him. I fought him. And this time I won. We stood there for a good 10 minutes, and finally Julian broke away, snarling, and retreated up the stairs to his cabin, Sour Billy scurrying after him. The rest of my people stood staring at me, astonished. Raymond Ortega stepped forward and challenged me. In less than a minute he was kneeling. "Blood Master," he said, bowing his head. Then, one by one, the others began to kneel. Armand and Cara, Cynthia, Jorge and Michel Lecoeur, even Kurt, all of them. Simon had such victory on his face. So did others. Julian's had been a bitter rain for several of them. Now they were free. I had vanquished Damon Julian for all his strength, for all his age. I was the leader of my people once again. I realized then that I faced a choice. Unless I acted, and quickly, the fever dream would be discovered, and I and Julian and all our race would die.
What did you do?
I found Sour Billy. He had been mate, after all. He was outside Julian's cabin, confused, cowering. I put him in charge of the main deck and told the others to do as he told them. They worked, as stokers, as strikers, as engineers. With Billy half scared to death and giving orders, they got our steam up. We fueled her with wood and lard and corpses. Ghastly, I know, but we had to get rid of the bodies, and we could not stop to wood up without great risk. I went up to the pilot house and took the wheel. Up there, at least, no one had died. She ran with all her lights out so no one could see us, even if they had eyes to penetrate that fog. At times we had to take soundings and creep along, and other times, when the fog pulled back from us, we slid downriver fast enough to make you proud, Abner. We passed a few other steamboats in the dark, and I whistled to them, and they whistled back. But no one got close enough to read our name. The river was empty that night. Most of the traffic tied up because of the fog. I was being a reckless pilot, but the alternative was discovery and certain death. When dawn came, we were still on the river. I would not let them retire. Billy had the tarpaulins rigged around the main deck as protection from the sun. I remained in the pilot house. We passed New Orleans near sunbreak, went downstream, and turned off into the bayou. It was narrow and shallow, the most difficult part of the trip. We had to sound every inch of it. But finally we reached Julian's old plantation. Only then did I let myself seek the shelter of my cabin. I was badly burned. Again. He smiled ruefully. "I seem to have made a habit of that," he said. The next night I surveyed Julian's land. We had tied up the steamer at a half-rotted old wharf on the bayou, but she was too conspicuous. If you thought to come to Cypress Landing, you would find her easily. I was loath to destroy her, since we might need the mobility she gave us, yet I knew she had to be better hidden. I found my answer. The plantation had once been given over to indigo. The owners had begun growing the more lucrative sugar cane more than 50 years before, and of course Julian had grown nothing at all. But well south of the main house I found the old abandoned indigo vats on a waterway leading from the bayou. It was a still, stagnant backwater, overgrown and foul-smelling. Indigo is not wholesome. The channel was barely wide enough for the fever dream, and clearly not deep enough. So I contrived to deepen it. We unloaded the steamer and worked at clearing the undergrowth and cutting back the trees and dredging the backwater. A month of labor, Abner, nearly every night. And then I took the steamer down the bayou, angled her into the backwater with much difficulty, and squeezed her through. When I stopped her, we were scraping bottom, but she was essentially invisible, screened on all sides by foliage. In the weeks that followed, we dammed up the mouth of the backwater where it met the bayou, replaced the mud and sand we had so laboriously dredged out, and endeavored to drain the waterway. Within a month or so, the fever dream rested on damp, muddy ground, veiled by live oak and cypress, and no one would ever guess there had been water there. Abner Marsh frowned unhappily.
"That's no goddamn end for a steamboat," he said bitterly. "Not her, especially. She deserved better than that."
"I know," said Joshua. "But I had the safety of my people to think about. I made my choice, Abner, and when it was done, I was pleased and triumphant. We would never be found now. Most of the bodies had been burnt or buried. Julian had hardly been seen since the night I had defied and conquered him. He left his cabin infrequently, and then only for food. Sour Billy was the only one who spoke to him. Billy was afraid and obedient, and the others all followed me, drank with me. I had ordered Billy to remove my liquor from Julian's cabin and keep it behind the bar in the main saloon. We drank it every night with supper. There was only one major problem remaining before I went on to consider the future of my race. Our prisoners. Those passengers who had survived that night of terror. We had kept them confined all during our flight and labours, though none of them had suffered harm. I had seen that they were fed and well-treated. I had even tried to talk to them, to reason with them, but it was useless. When I entered their staterooms, they would become hysterical with fear. I had no appetite for keeping them caged up indefinitely, but they had seen everything, and I did not see how I could safely let them go. Then the problem was solved for me. One black night, Damon Julian left his cabin. He still lived on the steamer, as did a few others, those who had been closest to him. I was ashore that night with a dozen others working in the main house, which Julian had allowed to deteriorate shamefully. When I returned to the fever dream, I found that two of our prisoners had been taken from their staterooms and killed. Raymond and Kurt and Adrienne were sitting in the grand saloon over the bodies, feeding, and Julian was presiding over it all. Abner Marsh snorted.
"Damn it, Joshua, you ought to have killed them when you had the chance."
"Yes," Joshua York agreed, much to Marsh's surprise. I thought I could control him. A grievous error. Of course, that night he re-emerged, I tried to rectify that error. I was furious and sick. We exchanged bitter words, and I was determined that this would be the last crime of his long and monstrous life. I commanded him to face me. I intended to make him kneel and offer up his own blood, again and again if need be, until he was mine, until he was drained and broken and harmless. He rose and faced me, and... York gave a hard, hopeless laugh.
"He beat you," Marsh said.
Joshua nodded. "Easily. As he had always done before, except that one night. I summoned up all the strength and will and anger that was in me, but I was no match for him. Even Julian did not expect it, I think." He shook his head.
"Joshua York, King of the Vampires.
I failed them again. My reign lasted for just over 2 months. For the past 13 years, Julian has been our master."
"Your prisoners?"
Marsh asked, knowing the answer but hoping he was wrong. "Dead. They took them one by one over the months that followed." Marsh grimaced.
13 years, that's a long time, Joshua. Why didn't you run off? You must have had a chance."
"Many," Joshua York admitted. "I think Julian would have preferred that I vanish. He had been Bloodmaster for 1,000 years or more, the strongest and most terrible predator ever to walk the earth, and I had made him a slave for 2 months. Neither he nor I could account for my brief, bitter triumph, but neither could we forget it. We struggled again and again over the years, and each time, before Julian brought all his power to bear, I saw the flicker of doubt, the fear that maybe this time he would be overcome again. But it never happened, and I stayed. Where would I go, Abner, and what good could I do? My place was with my people. All that time I continued to hope that some day I could take them back from him. Even in defeat, I believe my presence was a check on Julian. It was always I who initiated our contests for mastery, never him. He never attempted to make me kill. When supplies of my drink ran low, I set up my equipment and made more, and Julian did not interfere. He even allowed some of the others to join me. Simon, Cynthia, Michelle, a few others. We drank and stilled the thirst. For his part, Julian kept to his cabin. You might even say he was dormant. At times, no one but Sour Billy would see him for weeks. Years passed that way, with Julian lost in his own dreams, though his presence hung over us. He had his blood, of course. At least once a month, Sour Billy would ride into New Orleans and return with a victim. Slaves before the war. Afterward, dance-hall girls, prostitutes, drunks, scoundrels, whomever he could entice out to us. The war was difficult. Julian stirred during the war and led parties into the city several times. Later, he sent out the others. Wars often yield up easy prey for my people, but they can also be dangerous, and this war took its toll. Kara was attacked by a Union soldier one night in New Orleans. She killed him, of course, but he had companions. She was the first to die. Philip and Alain were arrested on suspicion and imprisoned. They were shut up in an outdoor stockade to wait for questioning. The sun came up and both of them died. And troops fired the plantation house one night. It was half ruined anyway, but not empty. Armand died in the blaze, and Jorge and Michel were horribly burned, though they recovered. The rest of us dispersed and returned to the fever dream when the marauders had gone. It has been our home ever since. The years have passed with a sort of uneasy truce between Julian and myself. There are fewer of us, barely a dozen, and we are divided. My followers have my liquor, and Julian's have their blood. Simon, Cynthia, and Michelle are mine, the others his, some because they think as he does, others because he is bloodmaster. Kurt and Raymond are his strongest allies. And Billy. His expression was grim. Billy is a cannibal, Abner. For 13 years, Julian has been making him one of us, or so he says. After all that time, the blood still makes Billy sick. I have seen him retch on it a dozen times, but he eats human flesh eagerly now, though he cooks it first. Julian finds that amusing.
You should have let me kill him.
Perhaps. Though without Billy, we would have died on the steamer that day. He has a quick mind, but Julian has twisted him terribly, as he twists all those who listen to him. Without Billy, this way of life Julian has constructed would collapse. It is Billy who rides into the city and brings back Julian's sorry prey. It is Billy who sells off the silver from the boat, or parcels of land, or whatever else is needed to keep some money on hand. And, in a sense, it is because of Billy that you and I have met again.
I figured you'd get to that sooner or later, Marsh said. You've been with Julian a long time without running off or doing nothing. Only now you're here, with Julian and Sarah Billy hunting for you, and now you write me this goddamn letter. Why now? What's changed?
Joshua's hands were tight on the ends of his armchair. The truce I spoke of is over, he said. Julian is awake again.
How?
Billy, said Joshua. Billy is our link with the world outside. When he goes into New Orleans, he often brings back newspapers and books for me, along with food and wine and victims. Billy also hears all the stories, all the talk in the city and along the river.
So? Said Abner Marsh.
Of late, much of that talk has been about one topic. The papers have been full of it, too. It is a topic dear to your heart, Abner. Steamboats. 2 steamboats in particular. Abner Marsh frowned.
Natchez and the Wild Bob Lee, he said.
He couldn't see what Joshua was getting at. Precisely, said York. From the papers I have read and the things Billy has said, it seems that a race is inevitable.
Hell yes, said Marsh. Soon, too. Leathers has been bragging all up and down the river, and he's starting to cut into the Lee's trade bad from what I hear. Cap'n Cannon ain't gonna stand that long. It ought to be a hell of a race, too.
He tugged at his beard.
Only I don't see what that's got to do with Julian and Billy and your damned night folks.
Joshua York smiled grimly. Billy talked too much. Julian grew interested, and he remembers Abner. He remembers that promise he made to you. I stopped him once. But now, damn him, he intends to do it again.
Do it again?
He will recreate the slaughter I found on the fever dream, said Joshua. Abner, this business between the Natchez and the Robert E. Lee has caught the interest of the whole nation. Even in Europe, large wagers are being placed, according to the papers. If they race from New Orleans to St. Louis, it will take them 3 or 4 days. And 3 or 4 nights, Abner. And 3 or 4 nights. And all of a sudden Abner Marsh saw where Joshua was going, and a coldness settled on him such as he had never known.
The fever dream,
he said. They are floating her again, said York, clearing out that waterway we had filled in. Sour Billy is raising money. Later this month he will come to the city and hire a crew to help make her ready and man her when the time comes. Julian thinks it will all be very amusing. He intends to take her to New Orleans and land her until the day of the race. He will let the Natchez and the Robert E. Lee depart first, and then he will take the fever dream upriver after them. When darkness falls, he will close in whichever boat is leading, pull alongside her, and... well, you know what he intends. Both steamers will be lightly manned without any passengers to keep their weight down. Julian will have an easy time of it, and he will compel all of us to take part. I am his pilot, he laughed bitterly. Or I was. When I first heard his madness, I fought him and lost yet again. The next dawn I stole Billy's horse and fled. I thought that I could frustrate him by running. Without a pilot, he could not bring it off. But by the time I had recovered from my burns, I saw the fallacy in that. Billy will simply hire a pilot. Abner Marsh had a heavy churning in the pit of his stomach. Part of him was sick and furious at Julian's plan to make the fever dream some kind of demon steamer. But another part of him was entranced by the boldness of it, by the vision of his fever dream showing up both of them, Cannon and Leathers, and the whole damn world to boot.
"Pilot hell," Marsh said. "Them two steamers are the fastest things on the goddamn river, Joshua. If he lets them get off first, he ain't never going to catch them nor kill nobody."
But even as he said it, Marsh knew he did not really believe it. "Julian thinks that makes it all the more amusing," Joshua York replied. "If they can stay ahead of him, they live. If not..." He shook his head. "And he says he has the greatest faith in your steamboat, Abner. He intends to make her famous. Afterward, both boats are to be wrecked, and Julian says we will all escape to the shore and make our way to the east, to Philadelphia, or perhaps New York. He is weary of the river, he claims." "I believe that is so much empty talk. Julian is weary of life. If he carries through this plan, it will mean the end of my race." Abner Marsh got up off the bed and stamped his cane on the floor in fury.
"God damn it to hell!" he roared. "She'll catch him. I know she will. She could have caught the goddamned eclipse if she'd been given the chance, I swear it. She ain't gonna have no goddamn trouble outrunning the likes of the Natchez and the Bad Bob. Hell, neither one of them could ever beat the eclipse. God damn it, Joshua, he ain't gonna do this with my steamboat, I swear he ain't."
Joshua York smiled a thin, dangerous smile, and when Abner Marsh looked into his eyes, he saw the determination he had once seen in the planter's house, and the cold anger he had once seen when he barged in on York by day. "No," York said, "he isn't. That's why I wrote you, Abner, and prayed that you were still alive. I have thought a long time about this. I am decided. We will kill him. There is no other way."
"Hell," said Marsh, "took you long enough to see that. I could have told you that 13 goddamn years ago. Well, I'm with you, only..."
He pointed his cane at York's chest.
"We don't hurt the steamer, you hear? The only thing wrong with that goddamn plan of Julian's is the part where everybody gets killed. The rest of it I like just fine."
He smiled.
"Cannon and Leathers is going to get such a goddamn surprise, they ain't going to believe it."
Joshua rose, smiling. "Abner, we will do our best, I promise you, to see that the fever dream remains intact. Be sure to caution your men." Marsh frowned.
"What men?"
The smile faded from Joshua's face.
"Your crew," he said. "I assumed that you came down here on one of your steamboats with a party of men."
Marsh suddenly recollected that Joshua had mailed his letter to Fever River Packets in St. Louis.
"Hell," he said. "Joshua, I ain't got no steamers anymore, nor any men neither. I came down by steamboat, all right. Cabin passage."
"Carl Fram," Joshua said. "Toby, the others, those men you had with you on the Eli Reynolds."
"Dead or gone, all of them. I was near dead myself."
Joshua frowned. "I had thought we would attack in force by day."
"This changes things, Abner."
Abner Marsh clouded up like a thunderhead about to break.
"The hell it does," he said. "It don't change one goddamn thing, far as I can see. Maybe you figured we was going in there with an army, but I sure as hell knew better. I'm a goddamn old man, Joshua, and I'm probably going to die soon. And Damon Julian don't scare me no more. He's had my steamboat for too goddamn long, and I ain't happy with what he's done with her, and I'm gonna get her back or die trying. You wrote that you made a choice, dammit. Now what is it? Are you coming with me or not?"
Joshua York listened quietly to Marsh's furious outburst, and slowly a reluctant smile crept over his pale white features. "All right," he said at last. "We'll do it alone."